At Henry's Uncle, as a 501c3 nonprofit, we rely on your donations. Any amount helps, $1, $5, $10, whatever it may be. If you would like to donate, hit up our Patreon account, Henry's Uncle, or go to henrysuncle.org, and you can donate through there. Again, any amount helps, and we truly appreciate your support. So today we got Lance Orton back on the show. Hey, Lance, how you doing?
I'm great. Good to be back.
Yeah, thanks for joining us again. So you were back on. It's been a while, but you are the seventh episode. The whole episode was very well received by people who I've talked to. You know, they loved your insight, your honesty, your vulnerability too, and your road to recovery and comeback. So, you know, everyone really loved you. And you know, what was funny was I saw you on Facebook, I don't know, maybe a week ago. And you're kind of doing these step one, step two type deals of recovery during, you know, the coronavirus, and how you're staying, in recovery and, you know, getting your juices out and all that kind of stuff to, you know, get your mind going. So really wanted to talk to someone, you know, with the coronavirus, you know, getting, you know, laid off during that time, the anxiety, the isolation, the quarantine, everything like that. Kind of wanted to talk about that with you and what you've experienced these last 6 to 8 weeks. Cause, you know, when we talked, you were full go on recovery. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, for many people, you know, sadly enough, you know, this thing has, you know, taken their wind out of their sails and have, you know, potentially relapsed or financial hardships, all that. So welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be back. It's great to be celebrating sobriety in the midst of a global pandemic. It's interesting with the face that you mentioned the Facebook thing, because I'm not real active on Facebook. I mean, I'm a scroller, but not as much of a poster anymore. I when I got sober, I analyzed my Facebook page over the last 10 years, and I wasn't real proud of the things I was posting over the past through my addiction and shenanigans, if you will. First of all, you know, let my sponsees and other guys I work with that are earlier or have less time than I do during a very difficult time, particularly, you know, guys less than 6 months, where isolation can be an absolute disaster. And so I just started posting these tips for staying sober during a pandemic. And it's funny, as I started putting them out there, I realized all I was posting was the stuff I do on a daily basis anyways. Whether we were in a pandemic or a crisis, you know, another crisis, it's still the same tools I learned my first year in recovery. And, you know, I just wanted to be able to share to the people out there that may not have these tools yet, a way to see that, you know, we can get through anything. I mean, getting sober is the first step. And I think that the more tools we have, the better chance we have of not just staying sober, but living a fulfilled and joyful life.
And I know back in the episode 7, you talked about a lot of tools you received. What were, you know, some of the top, you know, say 3 to 5 tools that you received and, you know, how you utilize them now during this pandemic?
The first go-to is got to be gratitude. Well, the first one is don't use or drink. It's a pretty simple tip. If you want to stay sober, not using and drinking usually is the first step. With that said, I would say that gratitude is the most important, probably top two, gratitude and service. Gratitude for me really keeps me out of my head. And I was a heady guy before I got sober. And I realized real quickly that I was a heady guy in early recovery, trying to figure out why I was an addict, why this, give me the science behind it. And I wanted to know all of the reasons that could be proven to me. And that drove me nuts for a while. But one thing I learned is that gratitude, chemically, when you're in a state of gratitude, there's things happening in the brain. And I'm not a scientist or a doctor, so bear with me as I fudge the lingo. But you can't be angry or sad while being grateful at the same time. Pretty simple. It's impossible. And I read a book that says exactly why that is the case. There are chemical, you know, things going on with dopamine and serotonin, endorphins that are happening. And so that stuck with me. I was like, wow, so if I'm grumpy, frustrated, angry, whatever, if I just start doing a simple list of what am I grateful for, it just quickly takes me right out of that negative mindset to gratitude. And when I'm in gratitude, I don't want to use or drink at all. So that's number one.
And that's a tool. I mean, you know, I should be doing that every day. It seems like everyone should be doing that every day.
Absolutely. It's simple. Really way more powerful than just a sobriety tool. I mean, it's a life skill. And I encourage people to try it. Just give it a shot. You know, when you're laying in bed at night or you wake up in the morning and the first few things that go through your head aren't great, just start, man, I'm grateful for the roof over my head, grateful for food in the fridge, whatever the case may be. It shifts pretty quick. And I have to do that hour by hour. That's the key for me, is it doesn't work just in the morning or just at night. I'm reading a book by Richard Rohr called Breathing Underwater, and it's spirituality and the 12 steps. And it's really cool because it brings not just the 12 steps for people struggling with addiction, drugs and alcohol. It's like the 12 steps for life and how important they are. And one of the things Richard Rohr says is my condition is treatable by hour gratitude. I mean, hour by hour, you're driving down the freeway and someone honks or cuts you off or you're late or you can't afford or something, hour by hour. And it works. It's powerful.
So for you, you know, gratitude and service, you know, you're a big service person. You know, we can go into that because, you know, you work, you know, for a nonprofit, you know, called Because People Matter.
Yes.
And, you know, with the pandemic, you mentioned that you were laid off during that time, but you're still, it sounds like you were still doing some work for them.
Yes, we were temporarily furloughed, mainly because we are a service organization that provides mobilization, relief, and development to our unsheltered guests, to vulnerable populations, and to people in general. And it's pretty hard to do that when you can't gather, you can't provide services in the traditional manner anyway that we were. We've made some adjustments and we recently received the PPP loan. So we're back on track as of tomorrow with a paycheck, but the work never stopped. We just had to adjust. And I realized real quickly that there are still needs out there. People need to be fed. People need community. People need interaction. So we've been doing these SAC lunch drives, partnering with various organizations, families, groups, churches that are providing these really, really high quality SAC lunches. We collect them at a collection site or various collection sites, and then we bring them down to the shelters downtown that can't serve their lunches, breakfasts, and dinners in-house. They have to serve them to go. And that's just a huge strain on those organizations. So we've been delivering them so that they can hand these SAC lunches out to the guests and to go. And it's been so valuable, not just for the organizations and the unsheltered friends that we're serving, but to me, to have some purpose, to get out there and provide something, fill a need. And the beauty of it is it's just as much helpful to me, if not more helpful to me, to be of service than it is the people I'm serving. And that's sort of the beautiful thing about the program of AA and other sobriety programs, is that as soon as you take yourself out of the equation and start focusing on other people, beautiful things happen.
You touched a lot about that on you know, in your original episode. You know, for you, what does service mean, you know, especially, you know, during this time right now, you know, being quarantined, you know, isolation, with the uncertainty of when the next paycheck will come in, things of that nature. You know, it sounds like that service has really, really helped you.
It really has. The service part is a piece of that. And you mentioned something there that definitely I am not immune to fear and stress when it comes to finances and a paycheck. And as soon as I found out my paycheck was no longer going to be coming at the end of March, there was some initial panic and fear, and service helps. You know, I'm like, okay, I'm going to just do the job without the money. I started doing it while I was in treatment for free. And then I did an internship and I figured, well, we're just kind of back to square one. Let's just keep doing what I'm doing. But I'll be honest, there was still some fear around where is the paycheck going to come from? How are my needs going to be met, et cetera. And the third tool that I'll pull out real quick for me is faith. And it lies into the third step, or the surrender piece, or turning your will and your life over to a higher power, as we say in recovery. And that's an important thing because, you know, I choose the Christian God. That's just my preference. But here's the beauty of it. It doesn't matter where your higher power comes from or what it is. For me, it just had to be something else that made me not have to be the one in control. Because as soon as I start to control things and try to take steps to get the outcome I want, it never goes well. It never did before I was sober, and it certainly doesn't go well now while I'm sober. And that's the beauty of having faith that things will work out if you just turn it over to a God of our understanding. And again, it doesn't have to be my God or a specific God. It just has to be not you. And for me, ego is the main cause of my addictions. My ego doesn't get what it wants. If it doesn't get what it wants or it doesn't get its way, which is often in life, I turn to drugs and alcohol in the past. When I turn that whole stress or things that I can't control and things I'm worried about, if I turn that over to my faith, I have faith that things are going to work out. They usually do. I can't explain it.
Yeah, just happens.
It just happens.
So for people, you know, say that, you know, who don't have work right now, where, you know, they are either temporarily furloughed or they are now out of a job, you know, maybe they can't be of service at this time, you know, like the way, you know, you may be, you know, helping provide sack lunches, things like that. But, you know, what kind of other tips and tricks can you give them to really help maintain their sobriety, you know, during this anxious time?
That's a great question. And I realize that not everybody is fortunate enough to have access to nonprofit work or volunteerism, especially in a time where it's not easy to do, given our restrictions. A simple tool that I would say you can always do right now, even, is you pick up the phone and you can call somebody and you can just say, how are you? What do you need? What can I do for you? And just listen, just being listening to someone on the other end that may need to vent out wherever they're at, stress, anger, frustration, sadness. By just being an ear, you're being of service. Anybody can do that if you have a phone. It's simple, but it's powerful.
That's a good tip. Good tip. You always, especially this day and age, calling someone is not the norm anymore. But, you know, a text will suffice. But yeah, you know, calling someone, that voice to voice definitely is much more powerful, for sure.
Absolutely. And we all need that. I need that. I have, you know, 10 different people that have to listen to me whine and cry about stuff on a daily basis. So yeah. It's nice to be able to do that for others.
Yeah, that's awesome. Bobby, you know, to you, you know, someone in long-term recovery too, you know, what's been your tips and tricks going through this uncertainty these last 8 weeks?
I don't know if I've been as spiritually strong as Lance, but for me, one of the big things always, Lance, I don't formally go to AA, although Eric can tell you I'm one of the biggest proponents of it. I'm a huge fan of it. I think it does a great job. I take Anabuse. So have you heard of that drug, Lance?
Yeah.
So yeah. I was actually about to run out of it, and I couldn't find any of it at any pharmacy. So I think I told Eric about this, and I was freaking out about it. And now that I have some of that back, I feel much more comfortable. But to a few of your points, I agree wholeheartedly with calling somebody up and listening. Basically, for, you know, addicts, in my experience, and I'm sure it's the same as in your experience, we really need to talk to one another more than anything. And because it's just a different thing. And so in that conversation, when you're sitting and listening to somebody else and what's giving them a hard time, you're not thinking about yourself at that moment. It's probably one of the biggest things about it. And there's something about listening to somebody, and even if you give them shitty advice, like if you try to give them some kind of advice and you listen to them and try to understand them, it just makes you feel better. It's like going to the gym almost, or like taking a run. At the end, you kind of get the runner's high. I feel the same way. Like if I'm talking to somebody about this kind of a content, you know, that directly affects my life and theirs, because it feels like you kind of got together in a huddle and like got yourself like amped up to like, you know, go out and do the fight, is basically how it works for me. So that's a definitely a big thing. I speak to a few people that I went to treatment with, and I went to multiple treatments over the course of about 4 years, and I speak to less than a handful of people. But when I do call them, they call me, it's the best, because it just brings you back to the starting point. And the fact that you all started the journey together and you're all still going is very inspiring. So it helps me to move forward in that respect, for sure. And I just, your gratitude, I think that's huge. I'm glad that you said that, because I forget that at times, but that's one of the main things I will always tell people is the key to my sobriety, is being grateful. And it took me a while to learn how to be grateful for really small things. But I feel like if you focus on the smallest of small things, like I'm thankful for deodorant and toilet paper in this day and age, right? Or whatever it is, you know, it makes you realize that you got a lot to be lucky for, because a lot of people don't have that insignificant stuff that I just mentioned. So that it helps to like put yourself in perspective.
Especially toilet paper right now.
Yeah. You know, that's a good word, perspective, because, you know, Lance, back in your original episode, you know, we talked you know, quite a bit about your rock bottom and what you went through. You know, how did your rock bottom, you know, kind of prepare you for this uncertainty, for this, you know, pandemic, you know, that what we're going through right now?
Yes, that's a really good topic because perspective is really interesting when it comes to people's realities. And my reality today is that this pandemic is nothing compared to the rock bottom hell that I went through 19 months ago. And I have to be careful not to be too Pollyanna about it, not to say that this isn't serious. There's a lot of serious things happening right now, and my heart just sinks for those that are struggling health-wise and financially, and who knows what the fallout of this is going to look like over the next years. But I will tell you this, personally, for me, there's no one putting a gun to my head.
That's right.
I am not going through extreme opiate withdrawals, and I am not homeless, and I am not, you know, trying to figure out where the next meal and the next shelter is going to come from. That right there, I mean, because I got through that, I feel like I can get through anything. And the key is I just have to stay sober, first of all, and then start using those tools that we talked about. And there's many, many more. So perspective, and I have to be careful also because as people's reality, people's different perspectives are their reality. So not everybody is like me right now going, oh, this is fine. It's no problem. You know, there are people out there struggling, and I catch myself constantly going, okay, you know, listen to this person's perspective because it is their reality. My perspective is my reality.
That's a good point. Everyone's different in their way of life and, you know, financially where they're at or, you know, family wise or whatever it may be. And so everyone's, you know, pains can be different and, you know, we got to take those seriously. Going through this, these last few, you know, 2 months of uncertainty. And I don't mean to say this, you know, for a trigger or anything like that, but, you know, to Lance and Bobby, you know, has any of this made you think of going back? Just the massive anxiety and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I have those kind of thoughts, though. I wouldn't say like every day or anything, but very frequently I will revisit the decision-making process and whether or not it's good to be sober. And that's okay. Like I can't like fight the where my mind goes, but I just kind of let myself think it through for a minute. And then I'll realize eventually, like, you know, they always say in AA, you know, one day at a time, right? So if I want to, I can drink tomorrow. I could drink the next day. I could drink 4 months from now. I could even schedule it 5 years from now, make it a real big formal event. You know, it's not like alcohol is getting off the shelves and walking away and I won't be able to find it ever again. So that's kind of the thing for me is to like, there's something about that reminding myself that I could drink if I wanted to. And then I reflect on, you know, man, 16 plus months now of being sober and it's great and my life is turning around. So invariably I'll get to the point where I'm like, huh, you know, I think it's always going to sound good to drink to you, Bobby. I'm pretty sure that's how it's always going to be. And then I just, you know, kind of move forward. Like I can't really describe it. It's sort of acknowledging the reality of it and then being okay with your decision because it's not a perfect thing. It's not like I look at alcohol now and go, oh my God, that's disgusting. You know, I still look at it and go, oh my God, that's lovely. Like, look at that over there. It looks great, you know, but it doesn't mean that I need to go get any of it. So that's just kind of the process my mind goes through. And it's not always some very severe draw toward it or anything. And this time, I think it's more being inside reminds me of when I was like being, you know, quarantined or whatever you want to call this by government force. It reminds me of, no, it's the truth though. Reminds me of when I was drinking the most because I was like stuck inside all the time and I created my own quarantine by drinking. So maybe that reminds me of it in some sort of strange, like nostalgic, romantic way or something. I don't know, but that's the only like the thought process that I've had because the liquor stores are open right now. So I could easily just go up and have a field day up there, but yeah. I'm not.
Yeah, I imagine they're thriving, not just open, but thriving.
Oh, yeah. Sales are up like 30-something%.
Crazy. It's crazy. How about you, Lance?
You know, it's interesting. My experience is a little different in that, first of all, I'm an opiate addict. That's my number one problem.
I feel sorry for you.
You're right. Yeah. No, it hasn't been fun. Also, like I could say the same for alcoholics because it's a lot easier to go out and buy a bottle right now than it is to go out and get some heroin or Vicodin or whatever. But I will say this, I chose to take sobriety as a full everything, sobriety from anything that alters the way that I feel because my deep down my disease is that I want to change how I feel so that I don't have to feel the way I'm feeling. And another amazing tool I've learned in my sobriety is that your feelings don't define me. They're just feelings and they're very fleeting. They're like cravings. They come and go. And if you're aware of them, they just come and go. But the interesting thing is that I have not had a single craving or thought that I've had to process through about drinking or using any type of mind-altering substance since this started, and pretty much since my kind of big shift in treatment the first year. And I can't remember exactly when it happened. I want to say about 8-9 months, I had a spiritual experience where they talk about it in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where the obsession to drink or use is removed. And that happened for me. And it happened because I began to like how I felt sober. And that is true today. I don't have a desire to change how I feel. Even when I feel crappy or things aren't going well, or my way, I should say, not going well. It's not going my way. I know how to, I have, again, tools to process through that. So truth be told, of course, there's a thought. Let me see if I can put this, for me, my experience into words here. There's always that thought that I can drink like a normal person because I, and I'm air quoting here, I know this is a podcast, but I'm not an alcoholic. I'm an opiate addict. So I never drank like an alcoholic. So, and I'm a sommelier for crying out loud. I could probably go have a nice glass of Napa Cab with my ribeye and I'd be fine. Here's what I learned about that through others, alcoholics, addicts, excuse me. They've tried that. They were fine sometimes for 6 months, sometimes for 4 years. And eventually that chemical use for a chemical to change the way they felt turned back into their original addiction for me being heroin, sticking a needle in my arm and winding up on the streets. I don't want to do that ever again, ever. And if that means I have to give up my love for Napa Cabernet because there's a 1% chance that it will lead me down that dark road again someday, I'm just not willing to go back to that, period.
Yeah.
So awesome. I do have to process it. I shouldn't say that it never crossed my mind. Alcohol does cross my mind. Like I'd be fine. Opiates, heroin, any other of those, the drugs, they just don't because I like the way I feel today.
You know, with those cravings, I mean, you know, cravings come in so many different, you know, shapes and forms. What's a, you know, one or two tricks that you guys do that help suppress those cravings, you know, for, you know, if they come for 5 or 10 minutes, you know, to kind of get, what do you guys do to help them get out of your head?
I make myself drinks, like type of drinks that I would normally used to make, but without alcohol. I'm on a kick lately. I'm drinking tons and tons and tons of diet tonic water on the rocks with lime. I love it because as a drinker, I was always carrying around something. Like I never went anywhere without carrying something. If it was a water bottle full of vodka or if I was at home, I had a drink. Yeah. So I literally still do the same thing, but there's no booze in it. So yeah. I don't know. It's just like a little trick that helps me. It feels weird. Like if I don't have something in my hand, I feel like how I would feel if I was at a wedding talking to everyone and they're all drinking and I have nothing in my hand, not even a Diet Coke. So it's just the like holding it.
That's interesting. It's really interesting. What are the psychology about that is?
I don't know. Like here's the deal. It would be cool if I could like tap into my brain and do some sort of other mental exercise. But why would I if I figured out that this just works? So I'm like, it works. Okay, I'm just going to stick with it. And that's that. I don't need to know why it works. It's working. So it's cool.
Absolutely. That's an interesting realization is that, you know, why don't try and figure it out. If it works, it works.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Because if you're drinking as much as I was, hard liquor, and you're mixing it with things, I mean, you're taking in so much liquid every day and you always have a drink in your hand. So to immediately go to nothing, it's extremely hard. I mean, I feel like what I'm doing is like someone who's I used to smoke lots of cigarettes and now they use like a little vape pen and do it every now and then. It's sort of a similar type of a thing. It's a replacement for the activity of the ritual of it.
Yeah.
How about you, Lance? What did you, you know, so it sounds like you were, you know, still had those cravings for the first 8 to 9 months in sobriety. How did you keep those cravings, you know, suppressed and not let them get back to you?
The cravings that I had early in recovery, and they're still the only types of cravings I have, are from time to time a craving for the old life of the good times.
There you go.
You know, I had good times. I had good times up until my late 30s. And I won't go into the details, but you know, there's a drug culture that was a lot of fun growing up.
Sure.
When I got into the opiates, it stopped being fun. because, you know, heroin's not a social drug. It's just not. There are social drugs out there. So my cravings come in the form of social fun. But the thing for me is that, you know, I'm about to turn 45 years old this year, and running around like a 20-year-old at raves is just not, you know, it's not normal behavior. So I deal with the cravings in the sense that I build a lot. I'm building a life today that I want, and it's focused around, you know, a whole different framework of who I am and what brings me joy, and that goes back to like serving and helping others, not focusing so much on what I think I need or want, and partnering with the world instead of fighting it or trying to control it or create. And so that sort of takes the cravings away. Plus, it's an adventure too. When you don't know, we're all wired to want to know the outcome. You know, uncertainty, it can be fearful and scary. And for us addicts and alcoholics, it's why we numb up, because we feel out of control. Fear, as one author, and I don't remember who, described, is simply the feeling we get when we're not in control. And the reality that I've come to accept is that we're very rarely in control of anything. I can control my actions at a micro level, and that's about it. I certainly can't control you. I can't control the bridge that I'm crossing as I'm driving across it. I can't control the weather. These are just simple day-to-day examples that I think everybody can relate to. I just don't realize how much faith and surrender and acceptance and trust and all that stuff goes into day-to-day life. When I bring it to the surface and apply it to my addictions, it makes a lot more sense of why I'm an addict.
The control piece is something I need to learn too. You know, it's I always want to be in control of things. You know, it doesn't matter what it is, and when I know it's not, when I know it's kind of going, that control is moving away, that's when my anxiety starts building up. You know, because I suffer from severe anxiety, and I know my triggers. You know, the big thing for me is flying, and you know, people always ask, well, you know, I never really had an issue with flying up until I was about 25. For some reason, all of a sudden, just flying over water just freaked the hell out of me. Have no clue why that occurred. But I know if I was in the cockpit and I had the, you know, I think for me, it's also, you know, I used to get claustrophobic when I was young, you know, only a couple of times that came out. And then all of a sudden, you know, being in a, you know, passenger seat in the plane, there's no control whatsoever. You have no idea what the outcome is. You have no idea who the pilots are, what they're doing up there, you know, how their night was, you know, that's all the stuff that starts going through my head. You know, we'll be up till 6 a.m., you know, at the bar or whatever it may be. I have no idea, you know, to put, kind of put that, you know, trust into people on a day-to-day basis, I think is maybe something I have an issue with, but I know if I was in the cockpit and I could see out, you know, kind of have that almost 180 degree view, right, like they have, and see, you know, everything going on and see them pressing the buttons and whatever it may be, I know the majority of my anxiety would be relinquished. I know that for sure. So it is a interesting point to bring up. You know, it's something I don't focus on a lot is the control aspect. And I know I have that issue, and that's something that I need to learn how to kind of surrender, I guess you can say, and, you know, let someone else deal with it.
Right. That's powerful stuff. I think there's a world of humans in general. You know, we're naturally wired in addictive behaviors in general. And, you know, there's so much focus on the alcohol and drug aspect of it. But the reality is that almost every human being suffers from at some level of addiction, whether it's to people or food or exercise or, you know, whatever it is. And it all comes from fear, I believe, fear and not liking things the way that they just accepting things the way that they are. That whole cliche, and I'm sure, Bobby, you've heard it, life on life's terms. I didn't understand that forever. I mean, it took me well over a year before I'm like, life on life's terms. I'm so tired of these cliches. Well, first thing I've realized is that they're all true, every single one of them. And the life on life's terms is that acceptance and surrender. Surrender first and then acceptance. You know, once I learned to surrender to the way the world works. When the world shows up the way the world shows up, you can either resist it and fight it, or you can accept it. And that, to me, is finally making sense of life on life's terms.
I think people often mistake the term accept for surrender.
Yes.
They think that you mean like surrendering to it. You're not going to do anything. Like if something bad happens, you're just going to sit there. No, it's not that at all.
Absolutely.
It's, surrender, there's a difference.
Yeah, I think that's great. Glad you brought that up, because surrender, people think of that as kind of a pacifist or a weak stance. And the reality is it's a warrior stance. To surrender is like, that's an active, assertive, takes discipline, takes strength, courage, fortitude, all that good stuff. It's not easy.
You know, I love poker. That'd be like, it's just like folding. Folding's not a sign of weakness. It's that, you know, you don't have a winning hand. You're going to wait for another one.
I love it.
That's just how it works.
Great analogy.
Yeah, it's a great analogy. So Lance, moving on past the pandemic, you know, you gave amazing insight into what you've been through, you know, being furloughed and how you dealt with, you know, not having the paycheck and the stress and anxiety there and what's keeping you in your momentum moving forward. You know, what's, you know, personal goals, you know, what are you setting yourself out right now, you know, in terms of personal goals and where you kind of want to be in the next year or two and how that helps you, you know, keep your sobriety?
Great question. What are my personal goals? Had a little time to think about that lately.
Yeah.
And it used to be, you know, get a good job, make a good living for myself, et cetera, et cetera. And I realized in that thinking how much my identity was wrapped up in my job and my title and, you know, my college degree or what have you. And, you know, what I've learned very recently is that when you take that all away, when a pandemic comes and you're stripped of everything except for the core of who you are, who I am, I had to really ask, who am I and what do I want to be? Who do I want to be moving forward? And I realized that instead of like calling it a career or a job or what am I going to do, I've decided to look at this as, what is my calling? You know, why am I here and what do I have to offer? What am I an expert in? The reality is, the only thing that I can claim to be an expert in right now is getting sober, staying sober, and living a full life. As long as I stay sober, I seem to be an expert in that. So I've been cultivating that into, how can I turn that into a calling, vocation, that means, you know, also a paycheck and a career. And I've got some pretty good ideas. You know, I have an entrepreneurial spirit, so it's definitely not going to be down the road of a normal paycheck type job. But the beauty of working with nonprofits and Because People Matter is that we're a development organization. And our third mission is development of people. And my title, the director of development, as you would have it, means that I get to look at what does the organization BPM, along with our founders, Leslie and Marshall Snyder, what does BPM look like moving forward post COVID-19? What does it look like? It's certainly not going to look like we had planned for 2020. Fundraisers, galas, our night strike under the Burnside Bridge on Thursday nights may not come back anytime soon. So what does that look like? And it's just such a blessing to be able to be part of developing and getting creative a new vision for this organization. And my personal goal would be to create some type of experience, workshop, seminar, program, whatever you want to call it, that helps fill that gap in recovery between getting sober, which, you know, can take a year or so, say, between lifelong sobriety and fulfilled life and joy and all that stuff. There's a huge gap, especially for guys and men and women who go through treatment. They graduate, they got sober, great. Now what?
What happens? Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, sometimes life's going to be the way life is. And it's like, wow, this is life. I'd rather just be high or drunk. And so I'd love to be able to share what I've learned in how to stay joyful and have an amazing life in sobriety, especially even during a pandemic. I mean, day to day, I found a way to stay pretty, pretty happy. And so I want to create a program that uses my experience along with many, many, many others, and share that with guys and gals that have just gotten out of some kind of treatment, or maybe they're at that year-long milestone and it's like, what does life look like next? So yeah, it's whiteboard. We're totally on the whiteboard here. I got some work on the elevator pitch, but I think that the future and my goals lie somewhere in helping people and helping fill that
more
gap.
Service.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's one of the things I've been thinking about quite a bit, is getting into this space and seeing that it's a big moment for people when they, you know, become sober and kind of accept, you know, the sobriety and the new life. But then again, is what happens after that? And that seems like you just said that there's such a large gap there that really needs to be fulfilled. It sounds like you're whiteboarding it out right now and definitely want to help people out. But to me, that seems like a really fairly large gap in the community.
Well, and the success rate numbers are terrible. And Bobby, maybe you can correct me or fill me in, but from what I understand, it's like 10% of the people that get sober actually stay sober for life. And I know in the opioid world, it's like 3%. It's even less.
That could be true. I have no reason to doubt those numbers at all. I just haven't looked into it. But yeah, I mean, look, it's a daunting thing. It's a terrible fatal disease that's just always waiting to like stalk you down and kill you, for God's sake, is what it's doing. So if you're able to survive the addiction reaper and just meet the normal reaper at the end of your life, that's a pretty good success.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure it is small, but I feel like the older and older you get, the less likely you are to slip back into it.
Right.
I think it just keeps building on itself. I mean, it has to. I feel that way currently, that it's building on me. And I know I'm going to encounter tons of new scenarios and things this year that'll either require me to, you know, go back to what I was doing or stick with the noble path here and try and stay sober. And I think every year you just get a little bit stronger. But yeah, isn't that something to hear those numbers?
It's frightening. It's unacceptable.
That's why it makes me sick in this time to know that people who really need services in mental health and addiction are just getting screwed. And they're creating a bunch of new addicts on top of it, which is even sicker. So I don't know if people really know the extent what this is doing to people who are actively in addiction or borderline or just newly sober or any of those things, man. We're talking about 3%. What do you think the success rate of people is during this? I mean, liquor sales are up tremendously. Obviously, there's a lot of, you know, quote, normal people drinking right now too, but a lot of that demand's obviously taken up by people like you and me. And that's been bumming me out during this time, really. I've really been focused on that. It's actually bothers me a lot to know that that's going on right now. Because look, you can't even get to an AA meeting in person. Someone could, you know, tell me to their blue in the face that virtual AA meetings are great, but I say that's bullshit because they're not. AA meetings aren't meant to be done virtually. You're supposed to look somebody in the eye and speak with them, and you know, gasps. You're supposed to shake their hand or touch them on the shoulder, or give them a hug, all that kind of stuff. So to say that that's not a huge impact on people, that doesn't even make sense. If people need that, it's like someone who's religious and they go to mass a couple times a week or church a couple times a week or whatever, a couple times a week. If you take that away, that's a huge blow to that person because at the end of the day, the programs that we're speaking about, not all of them are, but the ones we're talking about today are spiritual programs. You're taking away from someone's spirituality is what you're doing.
Right. And I think there's an interesting, just hearing you say that, it brings up a tool that I have to use in that there has to be acceptance around that. I agree with you. Especially if these restrictions and guidelines that we have continue for much longer. You know, my AA meeting once a week is extremely, it's been twice a week. I go back to the treatment center city team that I was at, and that shut down right away. They won't even let volunteers in there anymore. And half the guys I sponsor are there. But I'm also part of the Loyola men's group. And I don't know if you've heard of them, Bobby. They've been around forever. And it's a large men's group, about 250 of us, 160 regular, very active members. And we went to a Zoom online Monday night meeting. And it was hard at first. But I will say this, it's better than nothing.
Sure.
And we have phone trees where it's extremely organized, where we reach out on a daily basis to people in our groups and everyone stays in touch with each other. So, you know, I have to accept the fact that this isn't the way I want it.
Sure.
And I have very little control over what our politicians are going to say is going to happen next month. But what I can do is I can stay sober and I can call three or four people a day and help them.
Absolutely. I agree with that wholeheartedly.
You know, how are the people doing? I apologize. I can't remember the
treatment center's name.
Yeah. The treatment center. What was it called?
Dante's Inferno.
City's team. That was it. I was thinking Team City, but yeah. So, you know, have you heard about any, you know, what's happening down there? How are people coping and how are they doing?
I have. I do. I bring sack lunches to them once a week and I check in with them from a distance and they're doing about as good as, you know, any 17 guys locked up in a treatment facility can be. I can tell you my experience there was only possible to get through a year was because we had outside people coming in regularly. Mm-hmm. and there was interaction, and I had a reminder that there's an outside world to get back to. And so I can only imagine how difficult it is for the guys that are there now that are literally on lockdown, especially the ones in their third and fourth phase, which is like after 9-10 months of being there. Man, I tell you what, they're going to be stronger than I was when they graduate.
Well, I'm glad they're doing well. You know, it's, yeah, that's gotta be tough. You know, with 17 men in there locked down and everything going on mentally, it's tough just on everyone. And so, glad they're doing well and you're doing what you're doing, you know, being able to provide lunches and check in from a distance. So that's awesome.
Yeah. It's just interesting in that, you know, I have to keep telling myself that it could be worse. I mean, I could be dealing with this and then also going through withdrawals or, you know, Bobby, you touched on this too. Like we can go outside and grab something to drink and, you know, numb up and feel good for a day, a night, you know, maybe a week, maybe even, you know, a few years. But at the end of the day, we both know where that path leads. We've been down it long enough. And that's a big, you know, play the tape. Another cliche, play the tape through. How does it end if I do that first line, that first drink?
It's true though.
It is true. We know.
Yeah.
It's very simple. They always say this program of Alcoholics Anonymous or any recovery program, it's not easy, but it's simple. It's very simple.
Well, it looks like you both got to get some haircuts.
Me?
Yeah, you guys are getting some long hair over there.
Rumor has it I might be getting a haircut today. I don't know though.
What's that?
I said rumor has it I might be getting a haircut today, but I don't know about that.
We'll have to take that off the podcast. Yeah, make sure no authorities come to you.
They can't.
Well, I never said if I was cutting my own hair, if someone in this house is cutting my hair, if Kate Brown's driving here and cutting my hair.
Oh man. Well, Lance, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Lance.
You know, thank you for, posting those tips on Facebook. Find people, or you can find Lance, just typing in, Lance Orton, ORTON on Facebook and see his tips. They're simple, but they're effective. So.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you, Bobby, for your perspective. It's always interesting to hear, you know, I get so wrapped up sometimes in my own perspective that I forget that other people's programs are their programs. And
oh yeah, everyone's different. I like talking to people though, that have the classical foundation, like, you know, here's just what I found. I feel like people in 12 step programs are very successful compared to any other way you could do it. So it's nice to hear some of the principles like repeated back to me that I haven't heard in a while. I enjoy it.
Awesome, man.
Hey, everyone. We are really excited here at Henry's Uncle. We have formed a partnership with the Cash App. The Cash App is an app that empowers people to control their own finances. Same here at Henry's Uncle, where we want to empower people to share their own experiences around their addiction. When you download the Cash App, enter the referral code Henry's Uncle. You get $5. Henry's Uncle gets $5. It's a win-win for everyone. You can download the Cash App on your Apple or Android device.
Thank you for listening to the Henry's Uncle podcast. Please take a second to like, subscribe, or rate us. But more importantly, please share this podcast with anyone who may be interested in the topics discussed so they know they are not alone. As always, at Henry's Uncle, you are loved, never judged.